Hello.
Hi, Kevin. Henrik here.
Hello, Henrik. Pleased
to
meet you on Skype. I am okay. How are you?
Very good. Let me turn you up a bit in my headphones. You were a bit low there for some reason. Let me see. Oh, wait. That's on my end. That's on my on the Skype computer itself.
Okay.
Let's see. That should be a bit. That's better. That's better.
Am I close enough to the microphone?
Yeah. You always sound good in your recordings as well, by the way.
Okay. It's the same microphone. I did have a two-hour internet outage yesterday. I hope that does not happen again today while we're talking.
Oops. All right. Well, that's the upside of being pre-recorded instead of live, you know?
Yes.
You can always repair it in case, you know? All right. Very good. Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you, Kevin. I've known about your work for, a couple of years, maybe? Very good to have you here. It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. There's a lot we can discuss. I wanted to, if you don't mind, in the beginning, we can talk a bit about, you know, how you got involved in all of this. We can talk a bit about the National Alliance, you know, your show, some of the with the National Vanguard as well, of course. And really, from there, we can go anywhere we want. I wanted to get your take on Trump today. I wanted to ask you a bit about, you know, the rise of the alt-right and some of your opinions on those, considering we've seen a quick but recent rise in that compared to maybe what some of the work that you've been doing, which has gone over a longer time. So I think it would be interesting to kind of get your perspective on that.
Okay, sure. We can talk about all those things. That sounds good to me.
Very good. Is there anything else you want to make sure that we do get into? Anything at all that stands out? I mean, we can talk about obviously what you know, how you see things, our struggle, what we stand you know, in front of the nature of the problem basically that we are facing today, and what we need, you know, to turn that around. These are some of the big scope questions we can get into. But is there anything you feel we should make sure to mention?
Well, of course, I'm working with the National Alliance, so I want to make sure that is clear, that the National Alliance is the focus of my life energies right now, and that it is functioning and operating, and we have a program that we're trying to implement, and I'd like to, you know, make sure that is clear to your listeners.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's get into it and talk about that. So, are you good to do our proposed? We usually do about 2 45-minute segments. Is that okay with you, time wise?
That sounds fine. That should mean that we're probably going to get done a little before 6 my time, so that's no problem at all.
Very good. All right. Well, do you have any other questions for me about the format or anything else?
No, just wanted to say your production looks very professional, both the website and the videos that I have seen. I watched some of your live coverage. I believe it was one of the debates, and you're right up there in professionalism with the major networks, and I'm very impressed.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, we're actually really just getting started. I've just been doing you know, this kind of video end of it. I've been doing radio for over 10 years, actually, or for about 10 years. And the video aspect is just earlier in May, I believe, or March, we actually started to launch that. So we have a long way to go, a lot of more things to do. So but that's good. I'm glad to hear that it's looking good, at least, you know?
Very much so. Better than Alex Jones, in my opinion.
Well, thank you. He's aged pretty bad, you know, to be honest.
Well, I wasn't referring to your looks. I was referring to the professionalism of the production. But well, yeah, you look better than Alex Jones, too, if you want to kiss right down to that. Sure.
Alex's production looks pretty slick, though, I have to say. He has some good stuff, and his graphics is always nice and slick. And he obviously has more money than we do, but you know, he has a nice professional studio and even better cameras and things like that, so we'll get there. You know, he's been doing it as well, I think, for 15 years or probably even more. So
indeed.
Yeah. All right. So I'll record kind of a formal introduction afterwards. I'll just bring you on, Kevin, if you're ready, and we can go
let me
from
just
there.
Say one thing before you bring me on. That is,
sure.
I being of Norwegian descent, or maybe it's just my natural personality, I'm kind of a man of few words, so if I seem at a loss for words sometimes, just to prompt me with a question and I'll carry on. I'm pretty good at answering questions, but I just have this habit of compressing what I have to say into the minimum amount of time possible, and that's really a bad habit sometimes.
Actually, well, it's a good you know, we could talk about that later if you want, in terms of, you know, your delivery, but you know, I really appreciate that aspect of it, because You know, it's well written, it's thought out, and when you hear a show that you produced, it's, well, usually around 20, 25 minutes, something like that, right? But it's really compressed, it's dense, and a lot of, you know, thought in those processes. We have maybe a tendency to go for a bit longer in the interviews, which can be actually be a downside sometimes, I think. So actually, it's a good comparison, I guess, to what we do.
Okay, very good.
All right. Okay, let me start up my backup recorder here, and then the main one, and there we go. Okay, one second here. Kevin Alfred Strom, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for taking some time off speaking with us today.
It's great to be here, Henrik.
Very good. So let's talk a bit about your background, if you don't mind, first. You have Norwegian roots. You are behind American Dissident Voices. You're part of the National Alliance and also run the National Vanguard website. For newcomers who might not be familiar with your work, can you maybe tell us a few words when you got involved in National Alliance and what your relationship was to William Pierce?
I first met William Pierce in 1982. I had been involved in alternative political groups for a few years before that. And I was at a meeting of a constitutionalist group run by a very nice lady, Edith Bradbury, in Alexandria, Virginia, in about 1981, I guess. And I got a copy of a newspaper called Attack. And Attack was then the tabloid newspaper put out by the National Alliance, edited by William Pierce. And I was very favorably impressed and eventually called the Alliance, spoke to Dr. Pierce's secretary, Rosemary Rickey, and arranged to meet Dr. Pierce, and that was the beginning of our relationship in 1982.
So what pulled you in that direction to begin with? I mean, what, if you don't mind, tell us what kind of prompted you to start thinking in the terms that and the issues and the problems that National Alliance address?
I suppose it all began, if you want to go all the way back, when I was about 12 years old in junior high school. I had a several experiences that led me to believe that some of the things I was being told in the newspapers and on the television weren't true. One of those things was the ongoing chaos in the streets of America over the Civil Rights Revolution and the Vietnam War. I'll deal with the Vietnam War first. The protests at that time against the war weren't just against the war because the Vietnam War was bad for American interests. It was killing Americans unnecessarily. It wasn't really like that. The leaders of these protests were openly in favor of the victory of the communists. And some of these protests were rather violent, and it seemed very odd to me, even at the age of 12, that the leading lights, many of the leading lights of the establishment, people who were in the media, the commentators, the newscasters, the editorial writers at the time, actually seemed to be supporting these rioting Marxist demonstrators. And I just, something inside me said, something is very strange about this. Here's a group of people who are announcing they support Marxism, are announcing they want the overthrow of the current establishment, and yet spokesmen for that current establishment are saying, we sympathize with these protesters. In some cases, we support them. And the newspaper coverage was very favorable to these protesters, and I didn't understand. I wanted to understand. And so that was my first intimation that something very strange was going on in my country. And of course, I just had a kid's understanding of it. Around the same period of time, I had a teacher named Frank Herlihy. And Mr. Herlihy was a really extraordinarily good teacher on every level. He was a Virginia history teacher, and I had him for 2 years in junior high school. And he opened my eyes to so many things. He encouraged us to read serious books, even though we're just 12 and 13-year-old kids. He encouraged us to look at alternate views of history. He had revisionist materials. He had Western Destiny magazine. He had the American Mercury magazine. He had the Washington Observer, which was Willis Carto's publication at the time, in the classroom, along with other newspapers and magazines with a more establishment or even sometimes a leftist point of view. But he encouraged us to think about these things, and I think my friendship and the mentor with Mr. Hurley and the mentoring I got from him was a big factor in my beginning to realize some things that have been very powerful forces in my life. And one of the things Mr. Hurley told me about was that this civil rights agitation is not what it appears to be. And that was really the beginning.
Well, was he ever found out, the teacher?
No. My understanding is that he retired after a long and successful career, and in Virginia in the 1960s, perhaps he was able to get away with that. I think that today it would be a different story, unfortunately.
Yeah, it almost reminds me, what's that movie that was, I think, out of Canada? Was it Danger in Little Spring Rock or something? I forget the title now, but it was about the story of a teacher who basically was teaching some of the revisionist material to the students, and of course the movie depicted it as it was kind of creating some kind of cult or something. It reminds me of that kind of a similar scenario, you know, in the fact that sometimes, occasionally, you do get teachers that actually really stand out in that way, and they really manage to offer you know, their students something different, which completely kind of turned their world upside down in one way or another. Very good thing.
And there was another teacher who influenced me, but he really only influenced me profoundly on the very last day of high school. And I graduated from high school in 1974. And Mr. Malone was a science teacher, and he was a rather good science teacher. On the very last day of school, there's really not much to do. You're talking with your friends, you're talking in a friendly way with the teacher about your future plans for life, and all the exams are over, and so it's a very relaxed atmosphere. Well, on comes an announcement over the PA system in our high school, and I think they periodically had announcements by some of the students, and in between the announcements, and they had more than usual on that day because it was the last day of school, they would let the students play music occasionally. On comes this song over the PA system, and it's, I think it's called, I've forgotten the name of it now. I think it may be Louie. It's Brother Louie, that's right. Brother Louie by the Stories. And this was a song about racial mixing. It was about an interracial couple, and the song portrayed the relationship as a wonderful thing. But Mr. Malone went over to the speaker and had a switch on it, and he cut it off, and he says, "I'm not going to listen to that garbage in my classroom." And everybody was stunned because he'd never been a very emotional person before, and he was really angry. And he explained to the class in it was a restrained tone, but you could tell there was a lot of emotion behind it. He said that these people who put this stuff out, what they want is amalgamation of the races. They want to destroy you. They want to destroy everything you stand for. And I will not have that in my classroom. And it was, even though Mr. Hurley had encouraged me to look at things in a different way, I hadn't really looked at it in a starkly racial way. So even I was dumbfounded, and it forced me to think. And I didn't say anything at the time, but the seed was planted. And many seeds were planted over the years. I could go into more. Even when I was 7 years old, even though I didn't really think about race when I was 7 years old, that's when my family first came to the Washington, D.C. area. And I was unbelievably impressed by the beautiful classical architecture and statuary in that city.
Yeah.
And I had a thought, like, I'm a part of this. I'm a part of something great. This is something beautiful. It just resonated in me. And I think that was another seed that was planted that led me to where I am today.
Very good. Yeah, and you know, many don't wake up to these issues at all. In fact, they go in the opposite direction. They end up, you know, fighting these kinds of arguments. We can talk a bit more about that later. And by the way, for those of you out there listening, the movie I was thinking about was called Evil in Clear River. It's from 1988. It's a pretty good movie. It actually depicts, you know, this Canadian you know, teacher and how the kind of the community reacts. And of course, it's very skewed, the movie. It's very, you know, it's telling it from, you know, this perspective that he's evil and all this kind of stuff. But it's actually a pretty good depiction. But why don't we talk a bit about your kind of, I guess, if there's a way that you can give us kind of an overview to the framework of your perspective, if you will. If you would to explain to someone who hasn't heard about your work before, how would you present the image of how you see the world today in terms of the problems that we are facing and the concerns that you see in our world, if you can? I know it's a big question, but kind of like an overview, so we can get an insight into how you think a little bit, Kevin.
Well, we live in a world, we live in a universe that's evolving, and it always has been evolving, and it always will evolve. And we too, like all life on planet Earth, are evolving. We're evolving into something beyond what we are now. And once you see the world from an evolutionary perspective, once you see that all of life is branching and moving upward in evolutionary grade, and those that do not do that do not continue to live in this universe. Once you see that picture, then you understand what race, culture, and civilizations are all about. And that's about as broad as I can make it.
Now, you did one of the things that I like about some of your work as well is that you expanded beyond just the, you know, the political, beyond just the you know, the kind of more, it's not mundane by any means, but it's of course more you know, temporary issues, and you expanded into kind of eternal questions of philosophy and what's the purpose. You've even spoken quite a bit about you know, maybe our destiny going into space, going to different planets and these kinds of aspects, which is very, very interesting. You did a two-part recently on the issue of entropy. It kind of goes a little bit along with what you're talking about, over this fact that we're constantly fighting against kind of a natural form of degradation. Everything is slowly slowing down and breaking down, and we as human beings and as life overall is there in that process of kind of, you know, resisting that to a certain extent. And I find it really interesting to listening to that, because it takes it into a much bigger picture than just speaking about, you know, demographics or, you know, human biodiversity, that there's a larger and much bigger aspect to this and to what we are part of, and to the, you know, the legacy of philosophy and civilization that we carry as well. So it's a very important and big, you know, question at the same time in regards to, you know, if we lose Western civilization, if we lose European people overall, how many are going to carry the torch of the philosophical tradition? How many are going to carry the torch of, you know, space exploration and going to those extra extent that goes kind of beyond just the biological needs? Don't you agree?
I do agree. And I think if the European race does not survive, it is quite possible that life will eventually simply end and there will be no more, because life on Earth is very limited. In time, it is not going to go on forever. We have to become, as Elon Musk says, an interplanetary species if we're going to survive. And I think that the survival of the European race is essential for that to happen. In my series that you referred to, White Race and the Arrow of Time, in part two of that series, I brought forward a couple of graphs from Charles Murray's book, Human Accomplishment, and those graphs show quite dramatically how important it is that our race survive. It shows the scientific accomplishments over the last several millennia and the significant figures in scientific accomplishment over the same time period, and then it breaks it down over which continents, which peoples of those continents contributed. And in both significant figures and in significant accomplishments, Europe and European-descended people in North America contributed 97% of those accomplishments. And most of the remaining 3% were from the ancient Western world. In other words, they broke that down further and said the ancient Western world is a separate category. So most of the remaining 3% was also Europeans. And there were some contributions from the Arab world. There were some contributions from East Asia. But they were minuscule in comparison. And we are in a situation where our planet is not going to have fossil fuels forever. Our chances of maintaining this technology is limited in time. We cannot continue a technological civilization forever. If we're going to escape the bounds of Earth, we have to do it soon. There's no chance that if the European race is destroyed and our whatever it is about us, that special combination of intelligence and creativity that gives us that 97 to 99%, whatever that is may well die. And before any other race would have time over millennia to achieve what we have done, to get back to the point of intelligence and creativity that we have, if they could do that, the fossil fuels will have long since run out and technological civilization will be impossible and journeys to other worlds and to other star systems will be impossible. So it is absolutely imperative that our race survive.
Yeah, it's a very scary thought, to be honest, on many different levels. Let's talk a bit about then what you see happening right now, both in America and Europe, with mass immigration, with the promotion of diversity as the greatest thing ever, the lobbying for open borders. It's really a development of a cultural framework that states that this is moral, this is virtuous to have this kind of policy. And of course, we've seen on the flip side of that tremendous consequences, specifically in Europe, but also in America, of course, of terrorism, of a society that goes from being very high trust and a well-defined system of commons to basically falling apart. I think my country, Sweden, is a perfect example to that. I always bring it up to point to the fact that there is a tremendous change that have happened together, right alongside the demographic change in the last 30 years or so. How would you describe this, and what exactly it is that we're facing right now with the demographic change that's going on all over the countries founded and built by European people?
In my opinion, we are facing a deliberate attempt to exterminate our race. I believe that we are being genocided by a largely Jewish power elite that has created an inverted morality, which in all important respects is really the opposite of a proper morality, the morality that we instinctively would gravitate to if we had the right to form our own laws and institutions in our societies that were truly our own. And this inverted morality, whether it be promotion of mass immigration, whether it be promotion of convenience abortion, whether it be a promotion of wealth transfers to the non-white minority populations, the promotion of feminism, you can really understand where it's all coming from if you just stand back from it and see that this everything about this inverted morality is designed to minimize or actually prevent the births of white children. And everything that inverted morality is for tends to militate against more white children. And anything that is for more white children is regarded as evil by this inverted morality. And it's a morality that we simply will not survive if we continue to embrace it.
What do you think the reasoning is behind this? I mean, we address this question all the time on the show. Are we seen as an enemy? I mean, I think at this stage, Kevin, most white people, most Europeans, they don't have an ethnic consciousness at all. They don't even think, truly, I don't think they think in these terms. It's almost that the recent change that we've seen with identity politics and all these kinds of things, that has kind of pushed white people into a perspective where they have been forced to think about these questions or address it for the first time because they have been charged with crimes of being racist, for example, just for being white, for example. So to a certain extent, we've been cornered, right? But what do you think is the reasoning? I return to that point again. Are we seen as a competitor, as an enemy, or what drives our enemies, do you think?
I think the enemies of the white race include a lot of white people, obviously, and I think these people have accepted this morality. I think many, many people in every society, not just white societies, but in every society, are followers. They have to be. If you had all leaders, you would have chaos. You have to have leaders and followers. And unfortunately, the last few generations, including my generation, grew up under this inverted morality. They were taught that we must have a multicultural society, that it is somehow unfair, it's mean, it's even evil to have a society just for whites. That's evil. However, I don't think that white people are really the driving force behind this inverted morality. I think the Jewish minority, the Jewish power structure, who are the world's richest and most powerful ethnic group on planet Earth, designed this morality specifically to keep us under control, and if it happens to exterminate us, in to make the world safe for them and their way of life, they don't care. And they are, I think they had big trouble in Germany during World War II. I think that the German people were freed from their influence, and I believe there was a tremendous, obviously everybody who reads history books from any point of view knows there was a tremendous conflict between the National Socialist Germany and the Jews, and they don't want to take a chance on that happening again. And so they've doubled down on their anti-white, anti-racial, and really when it comes down to it, although they might not describe it this way, anti-evolutionary morality that they are imposing on us. And I believe that they have their own interests in doing so. They are a parasitic people. They are nomadic. They exist by living in other people's countries, and until very recently they did not have their own country. And they, because of that, they are constantly a minority in someone else's land. And it is much safer for a minority group, particularly a minority group that wants to make a great deal of money and hold power behind the throne, to be one of many minority groups. If you're the only minority group, you really stand out. And
right,
that can be dangerous to them. So they prefer to be one of many minorities. They feel safer under those circumstances. And I also think there's a biological evolutionary factor. They evolved as a wandering people. Even if you read the Hebrew Bible, their own myths show them as a wandering people. And they've always been a wandering people, as far as history knows them, among other peoples. And they evolved in that environment. Well, it's a truism that many, many animals, many, many living creatures in this world modify their environments to best suit them. And so I believe that on an unconscious level, to some extent, biologically, instinctively, and also at the highest levels, using their conscious minds, they are modifying their environment to suit their way of life. And that involves, unfortunately for us, destroying the racial integrity of our societies, and that will prove fatal to us.
Yeah, this is interesting. You know, the being a roaming people in that regard has been a tremendous downside for the longest time. But somehow they managed to transform the world really into a globalized world that we unfortunately have today, where they've taken advantage of this very aspect. But it seems, what's interesting too, Kevin, is that it seems that it's not enough to maybe stand behind then when we had the creation of Israel, and you'd think that this problem of sorts would have absolved itself. It would have been easier at that point and to say, okay, we have a country now, we have a homeland of our own, we can go there. But that hasn't happened really, right? There is still a very strong ethnic cohesion of these people within our own countries to still lobby for the destruction of our countries, like we can see with Barbara Spector, for example, in Sweden. And she's talking, of course, about all of Europe that needs to be multicultural. But this is an aspect which is interesting to me, because you think that it would be dangerous to them to a certain extent to push so hard that they have done, because look at the results now. I think we can see that people are actually starting to wake up to this aspect, where they before, as I said earlier, didn't even have a clue about these kinds of things. We weren't raised thinking about these issues. We weren't brought up to even consider race and these kinds of things. And today, coinciding, of course, with the rise of the alt-right and everything, we're seeing more and more people coming to the realization that, you know, human biodiversity matters. There are race differences, and that someone is out to get us. And this is isn't that a risk that they're taking to a certain extent, of pushing so hard that they have done? And this is something that, you know, will put them in a situation where they will be, you know, charged and accused with these crimes against against European people.
That seems to be the pattern of Jewish existence: peak and crash, peak and crash. But now it's not just peaking in England and getting thrown out of England, or peaking in Portugal and getting thrown out of Portugal. It's peaking in the world in terms of power and wealth, and angering many, many peoples in the process, and maybe getting thrown out of the world. It really seems to be all or nothing for them. They do not seem to be a people that can accept a position of reasonable profit and reasonable power and relax and enjoy the fruits of it. They seem to always be pushing, pushing, pushing. And the Zionist project seems to contradict their own psychology. In other words, they don't have a history of living in their, just Bible myths to the contrary, they don't have a history of living in their own country and subsisting by living off the land and having a self-contained economy. They have a history of living off other people. And so perhaps instinctively, unconsciously to some extent, they won't go to Israel in any really large and significant numbers. Only a tiny fraction of the Jewish population is in Israel now. And I also, how can they abandon their positions of power? They have a money monopoly in Western Europe. They have a money monopoly in the United States and in most of the world. They are dominant in the banking and financial sectors. They are dominant in the media. This is a tremendous center of profit and power to them. Just saying, well, we'll just sell it all and go to Israel, it just doesn't seem to be in their psyche. So I think, right, once again, yeah, it's peak and crash. And they create their own crashes, really, by their own actions.
I mean, how do they pull this off? I mean, the transformation or the inversion of values, where we've ended up now in a situation where we resent our own people. We, to a certain extent, hate our own civilization, what we've been created. We've been led to believe that all we brought was, you know, colonialism and slavery and, you know, rape and pillage around all of the world. And we've gone from a position where we were, you know, proud of being part of who we were. We were proud of, you know, our ancestry. We wanted to uphold and make sure that we continued and preserved, you know, what our ancestors gave to us, etc., to this place where we are today, most of us, where we resent our own, where the self-hatred is so strong that most don't even seem to care about that at all. It was not something that happened overnight, obviously, but how do you think that was performed? How did they manage to do that?
I think that white people in general are people who respect authority. We, through our own psychological evolution, we developed a respect for our own leaders. We developed a society where we respected the town, the village elders or the tribe elders. We chose our own leaders in many of our societies, or in some cases we believed our leaders were divinely chosen. But in any case, we respected the elders, the leaders, the people who were the authorities in our societies. And I think when the Jewish minority came into our society, not only did they bring with them their own evolutionary legacy of being very, very highly verbally intelligent and able to be very, very persuasive. That's part of their survival strategy when they live among other peoples. But they also brought with them a realization that the new technologies that they saw that European man had invented, the printing press, the motion picture, radio, and eventually television, these things had replaced in many ways the authority of the village elders or the village council or the tribal council in the minds of European man. And they saw it was wide open. All you needed to take control of the nerve centers and information and apparent authority in a society was to buy newspapers and then later radio and film production studios. And they did that. And they have, to a large extent, my whole childhood was immersed in network television and the lives of everybody around me, but my generation and the generation before me. Was immersed in network television and major newspapers. This is where people got not only their ideas of what was happening in the world, but perhaps even more importantly, their ideas of what others were thinking. And the Jewish minority controlled that. And I think they found us a very naive people who had basically evolved for tens of thousands of years in the cold north, where we had to trust each other to survive, and they found us very trusting and naive, and we believed the narrative they told us of their own suffering, of how they were a terribly persecuted people, and how we were very, very wrong to exclude them, and by extension, to exclude other races from our society. We bought into that. I think because most of us respect authority, and they had managed to get into a position of authority, sad to say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've seen Hollywoodism, based on the book An Empire of Their Own by Neil Gabler, where they kind of describe what you're talking about in a very frank and open manner, actually. And it's not maybe about the world's media or the creation of the you know, entertainment industrial complex that we have today, but they specifically frame it in the context of how they did this in America, of basically, as they phrase it in the documentary, they talk about creating a shadow America, one that is basically a facsimile, a version which didn't really exist in the 1940s and 50s and onward, but that this vision that they invented of sorts and put on the silver screen eventually overtook what they call the real America. And it's quite interesting. It's very interesting of how kind of candid and open, of course, and they do it from a perspective where they think that this is something good. We injected our morality and our cultural values into America, and then kind of the rest of the world has followed on from this as a consequence, where the whole globe is consuming Hollywood movies. It's pretty interesting. I don't know if you saw the documentary.
I have not seen it, but that's a very clever way of looking at it. And if you say it's coming from a Jewish source, then that's even more amazing, actually.
Oh, I'll send it to you. It's very interesting. As I said, Bill, founded on the An Empire of Their Own, that book where they talk about the major studio heads that arose after they took off from New York. They were actually thrown out of New York because they were stealing Edison's technology, and they refused to pay licenses for it. So they actually took off to the West Coast to hide from what they say in the movie was Edison's thugs, right, that didn't want to give them the technology. So anyway, I'll send the link to you. Very, very interesting. But what do you think is happening right now, though, with the media environment? We've seen a shift and a change with the dawn of the internet, and we're seeing a much more aware people to these kinds of aspects that we're talking about, an awareness of globalism, an awareness of this system of corrupt media. And we can get into Trump here a little bit later, but we even have, of course, a presidential candidate now that openly is addressing these issues using these words. I mean, I think it's tremendous. What do you think?
I think you've really hit on something there. Trump using those words. Of course, the National Alliance and other patriotic individuals in other countries has been telling these truths for 30 or 40 years. But a lot of people who might agree with us and who were influenced by us, I think, have been afraid to speak out, because they know how the system works. They know who controls the money. They know that the corporations and the politicians are intimidated by the media, and they know that they could easily lose their employment if they speak out in a way that is pro-white or that criticizes Jewish power or that in any way violates the taboos of political correctness that basically are the standards of this inverted morality that has been forced on us. So here we have Donald Trump. Now, I don't think Donald Trump is the solution. And I also don't think Donald Trump is one of us. I really think he's a multiracialist. I really think that his values are not our values, and he's not what we need. But Donald Trump is a frank guy who sees some of the more ridiculous, egregious things that are going on, and he just speaks frankly about them. He doesn't censor himself. I guess maybe it's his natural personality and reinforced by the fact that he's a man of considerable success and wealth, that in his own mind, I think he thinks that gives him the right to give orders and to say what he thinks, and to hell with the rest of the world. And that has caused two reactions. It has made the establishment very afraid of him, even though he's very tied in with the Jewish establishment. They're just afraid of him because he's a loose cannon and he tells the truth occasionally, and they hate people who tell the truth. And he's also his own man. He could turn on them in an instant, and might. And they don't want to take that chance. Hence, almost all of the Jewish power structure and their employees in the media and in the Congress and in the Senate of the United States are against him. But he has caused another effect among the people who used to be afraid to speak out. Like I said, many people are afraid of losing their employment. But, you know, if they just say something just a little bit more radical than one of the major presidential candidates, they figure that can't make me lose my job. Trump said almost the same thing yesterday. And also, right, they're authority worshipers. Most people are, to some extent, authority worshipers. And here's a really huge authority figure, one of the leading businessmen in the United States and the candidate of one of the major parties who may well get in the White House, saying some of these things. He's saying, you know, some of those Mexican immigrants are really undesirable. We need to build a wall. if that makes him, and the media are screaming, you know, the Jewish power structure is screaming, he's virtually Hitler when he says that.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, if a major political candidate can be virtually Hitler and yet get away with it, then the average person who's a little bit timid might say, well, maybe I can get away with a bit more too. And I think it's really brought people out of the closet, and that's where you have this alt-right phenomenon. I don't really think there is an alt-right movement. I think that's just a name that has been attached to this phenomenon, this tsunami, really, of awakened people finally getting the courage to speak up. And it's infectious. It feeds on itself, and it's growing every day. I'm on Twitter a little bit myself, and I see it constantly. It grows endlessly. And these people, I'm so happy to finally see it happening. You call them a bigot, you call them a Nazi, you call them all kinds of names, and you know what they do? They don't cower and hide and say, oh, please don't call me that, I'm sorry, I apologize. They laugh. That is
great. Right.
I've been waiting for that.
Yeah, it's true. You know, Trump is, you know, blazing a trail. I see that he's setting back those that have been pushing, you know, this narrative of political correctness, and he's, as you say, he's kind of blowing open a space which previously has been, you know, non-existent almost to a certain extent, where people can come into that space and feel, as you say, kind of freely to discuss some of these ideas again and address some of these issues. And it's interesting to see how quickly also that happened to a certain extent, how quickly many people got behind them. And I'm not saying, of course, that all of these people that support Trump share all of your values, for example, or all of mine. But nonetheless, Trump has, whether he wants to or not, become a kind of a symbol for that discontent, whether it's on a very, you know, low level, if you will, to one that's very high level in terms of, you know, how we see the world and the kind of the problems that we face. But I think that's excellent. I think it goes beyond just him as a presidential candidate. It goes to something much more deeper, and I think you mentioned this in one of your shows as well. You were talking about the fact that this is not the end. This is actually just the beginning of a kind of an awakening, and who knows where this will be. Well, obviously we have to see whether he gets in or not, but in even 5 to 10 years, this could have been growing into something which we can't even imagine today.
I agree with that, and I think it's going to happen whether or not Trump is elected. I think if he is elected, well, either he's going to move us in the direction that I want him to move us in, or he's not. And in fact, either of those two alternatives are still good, because if he does, of course, obviously that's good. If he will give us more years for the white resistance to organize and to grow and to educate more people. But if he doesn't, though, the number of supporters who think he's going to are going to be tremendously and profoundly disappointed and angry. And those people aren't just going to evaporate. That enthusiasm isn't just going to be stuffed back down into the rabbit hole. It can't be done. These people are going to coalesce, and some of them are going to see the fully radical vision of the National Alliance and William Pierce that I see and that I embrace. And I think the potential is infinite. And if Trump loses again, there will be a tremendous anger. And this is the first time in my lifetime, at least that I remember, that any presidential candidate has said he may contest the results of the election. And you know what? Just because he said that, even if he doesn't, plenty of people are. And that is a major questioning of the entire structure. And that paves the way for revolutionary thinking. And that's what we need.
Yeah, very good. You know, I can understand to a certain extent why people maybe are, you know, suspicious of Trump and, you know, of the people in his campaign and are they genuine and all those kinds of questions. But the very fact that, you know, the globalist forces, from the bankers to the media industry and the entertainment industry, they have declared their hatred for him so prominently that in itself should be a sign to people that, you know, he's obviously a candidate which they don't like. And just to be able to realize that, okay, well, then he's doing something right. I mean, we can't compare this with, you know, how they pushed Obama on the scene in 2008, for example, how they promoted him as a messiah, almost as a kind of a savior. They are using all their ammunition, everything they have, to discredit Trump every single day and destroy his campaign and his candidacy. And that, I think, says to me that it's like, okay, well, this is interesting. This unless that whole thing for some reasons would be a sham and they're just putting it on, it's just for show, then it means that, you know, he has something which they don't like, and that to me is reason enough to be supportive of him, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't think it's all theater. He's made too many blunders for it to be theater. Hillary Clinton's speeches are theater. I don't think Trump's speeches are.
But, right, yeah.
I think that it is real. I think it's really happening. It's not theater. And I think he definitely has all the right enemies. They don't trust him. And so, therefore, there must be at least a few good things about him.
Yeah, that is true. Hey, let's talk a bit about National Alliance, and maybe you can explain to people, you know, what the organization is, what it does, and some of the things that you think people should know if they're new to it. We're going to, of course, continue to talk more about this in the second segment. But before we take a break, let's discuss that a bit and tell us what you think the audience should know about the organization.
The National Alliance began as the National Youth Alliance in 1970. 1974, Dr. Pierce changed the name to the National Alliance because it began as an organization for students and young people who were trying to fight against the countercultural anti-white movement of those times. The National Alliance is a group of white men and women from around the world. Most of our members are in the United States, but we are not restricted to the United States, who believe that the future is what we make it, and we are determined to be participants rather than spectators, and we stand for not only the continued existence of the white race, but the fulfillment of the destiny of the white race in this universe. And we have printed publications every month. Our members receive the National Alliance Bulletin. We have a online news magazine, National Vanguard, which is at nationalvanguard.org. We have a membership website at natall.com. We also have a community in the state of West Virginia in the Allegheny Mountains, a little bit south of me. I'm in the Allegheny Mountains of Western Pennsylvania, but a few hundred miles south of me, we have an intentional white community in the mountains of West Virginia. And we are trying to build that up to be a place where our members and activists can eventually form the nucleus of a viable community and eventually a new society.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's a lot to discuss there, of course, in itself. And I wanted to, maybe we can do that in the next segment, talk a bit more about, you know, how that's going and if that's kind of as a future model of that thing. But tell us a bit more about just kind of the ideology. I don't think you exclude people per se, but it's not like a Christian organization, right? It has some roots in pre-Christian tradition, if I understand that correct.
Well, the symbol of the National Alliance is a letter from the runic alphabet of the Germanic peoples. We call it the life rune. It's also been called the man rune, and it's a symbol of a life and upward ascendant life, upwardly evolving life. And no, we're not a Christian organization. We do have some Christian members, but they are Christian members who put race first. The purpose of the National Alliance is to advance the survival and the interests and the upward evolution of the white race. And we believe we need a completely new society based on completely new principles in order to do that. And the leading figures in the alliance are adherents of the religion of cosmotheism, which was also founded by the same man who founded the alliance, a physics professor named Dr. William Pierce. And that is the spiritual basis for our political work.
Now, what are some of the things that, you know, yourself and William Pierce have been fighting against over the years? I know that there's been not only, of course, a struggle to wake people up, but there's been kind of an information war, if you will, of sorts on top of that. There's been accusations, attempt to discredit. There's been everything, as far as I could tell, to try to smear the group as much as possible to, I guess, just make sure that people stay away from it. Isn't that right?
There seems to be that kind of activity against any truly effective force for white renewal or white identity. The government will engage in dirty tricks. The intelligence agencies, whether they be private intelligence agencies like the Southern Poverty Law Center or national intelligence agencies, have very, very large budgets, unaudited budgets, to send in infiltrators, to hire media hacks, to spread rumors and false stories in the media and make us look like a bunch of degenerate criminals, and to try to break up the groups. In fact, I believe Heidi Byrick of the Southern Poverty Law Center recently said in an interview on PBS that that's what we do. We try to break up these groups. We try to shut them down. They don't try to debate us. They know that we're correct. They know our ideas are powerful. Their strategy is to shut us down, and I believe that government agencies have followed basically the same tactic. There was a program back in the 1960s that was exposed 10 or 20 years later, the COINTELPRO program, in which the Federal Bureau of Investigation infiltrated radical political groups, both left and right, and tried to steer them in directions that would destroy them. They tried to cause infighting between people who ought to have been allies. They spread rumors of sexual misbehavior or criminal activity. They actually incited criminal activity in some cases, and then reaped the quote-unquote benefit of destroying the groups that were then either their leaders were imprisoned or they were involved in ruinous civil actions because of the criminal activity that was actually incited by the government. And so basically, just as in wartime, no dirty trick or tactic is off the table when you're fighting a war. Governments do that sort of thing all the time, and it's expected. They have the same kind of attitude, both the government in the United States and certainly in other countries as well, and these private intelligence and dirty tricks organizations that the Jews operate, they have no compunction against using anything to stop us. Because I think really part of the strategy of our enemies and the people they employ in the government is to save the magic of racial nationalism for themselves only. That's really what the political correctness amounts to. It's racial nationalism for them, for the Jews, but we are forbidden to have racial nationalism, and so they want to destroy us. So yes, endless dirty tricks. I could go on for hours.
Yeah, I remember we did a review of Imperium, the movie, that actually showed some of this. I think it was Michael German was the intelligence guy's name. He would, I mean, it seems that they have an endless amount of resources and time and even willpower to spend on this, where they think that, you know, most of these people are radical terrorists. They're going to blow up buildings. You know, they're all Timothy McVeigh. So they create these sting operations where they have, and frankly, they've done this to some aspects and some portions of those elements within Islam as well that they consider to be, you know, maybe radicalized. They basically hand them, weapons and resources and everything else, and then they're waiting for a guy basically to be convinced into pushing a button, right? And before that happens, they arrest a guy, or they, you know, they do a mass arrest or something like that. But it's basically, you know, a sting operation to incite people into this aspect of it. And I wonder too if these things ever would be the case if the government wasn't there providing, you know, resource and material and ideological, you know, convincing people ideologically to go in that direction and things like that.
Well, one example of that was a man named Hal Turner, who, like me and like you, has had a radio show for many years that ostensibly was a very radical pro-white radio program. He was based out of New Jersey. And he was famous for his wild, over-the-top rhetoric. He would very strongly hint at, if not actually call for, violent action against people who were hurting the white race. He even hinted that certain judges that had allegedly ruled against a pro-white organization should no longer be alive on planet Earth. And that eventually brought him to grief. But he also, for a time, he tried to submit articles to nationalvanguard.org. I think I printed one or two of them that were reasonably accurate. But his articles, I began to distrust him when I found out that I was fact-checking the articles he sent to me, that he was wildly exaggerating some of the things he was saying in the articles. And so I sort of shied away from him, and thank God I did, because if I had maintained a close relationship with him, people in the National Alliance might have thought he was a fine guy and gotten to know him and contacted him, helped him with his radio show. And I'm glad that that didn't happen, because it turned out that he was all along working for the federal government and was paid by the FBI over $100,000 to entrap white Americans into committing crimes, and furthermore, even if he couldn't entrap them into committing crimes, putting their names in a database of people who should be observed. And so this, right. I'm sure he was exposed by chance because his handlers turned on him. Now, why exactly his handlers turned on him and sent him to prison, I don't know the answer to that question. But if he was exposed, I am sure that he's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, today it seems that they're more concerned with white people who have a concern about being, you know, racially, demographically displaced and replaced in their own countries than they do for Islamic terrorism, for example. I mean, it's remarkable, isn't it?
Yes, indeed, it is.
All right, well, let's talk more about this, and of course, much more in the second segment. I want to get into much more with you, Kevin, but give us some of the website. You mentioned, of course, National Alliance, National Vanguard. You have your own personal website. Let us know where people can go to read more.
Well, if you want to learn the core beliefs and principles of the National Alliance, you should read the articles that are up at natal.com. That's N-A-T-A-L. ALL.com. That is our main organizational website. There you will be able to purchase the speeches of our founder, William Pierce, on CD. You will be able to read our foundational documents, and I think it will give you a very full understanding of where we stand and where we're coming from. Also, if there's a contact form there, if people would like to write to me, I will be happy to answer their questions, or if I can't answer them, I'll pass them along to our chairman, Will Williams. We also have a news magazine site, nationalvanguard.org. That's all one word, nationalvanguard.org.
All right, very good. Don't miss Kevin's show as well, American Dissident Voices. Is that once a week?
Yes, I have a weekly radio program, American Dissident Voices, and you can see the last 10 episodes of that right on the front page of nationalvanguard.org.
All right, very good. We'll have the links up to the websites that Kevin mentioned. Do check it out. We'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us. We'll be right back with the second segment. All right, there we go, Kevin. We're off to record then for the first hour. Thank you. That was great.
Okay, very good. I hope I'm doing okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Do you want to take a short break before we continue?
Yes.
I'm going to use the restroom real quick here.
Yes, I'm going to go get another drink. I have drunk all my lemonade, so
yeah,
I need
go ahead.
A little bit more. I'll be right back.
Sounds good. Talk to you in a bit.
I am back.
All right, I'm here as well. Just making some more notes here for some additional points in the second. Anything major that I'm leaving out that we want to make sure we go into in the next segment?
At the moment, my mind is a blank. But if I come up with something, I'll just butt right in and say it.
Exactly. Just let me know. All right. Well, if you're good to go, we can fire up here.
Okay.
All right. Stay tuned. One second. Let's see. Check. Is that on? Yeah, that is on. Okay. All right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're speaking with Kevin Alfred Strom, I guess is the American pronunciation of that.
That's right.
He does have a Norwegian background. Well, I'll ask you about that in a minute here. But I just wanted to mention, if you haven't heard some of Kevin's shows, do take some time and listen to them. They're very inspiring. They're shorter, in some regards, but they're jam-packed with information, very well, written or thought out. And, of course, same thing goes for, William Pierce's speeches. There's many of them on YouTube. I don't know if you guys have archives of some of William's speeches on the website as well, by the way?
Yes, we do. There are many, many of Dr. Pierce's speeches and articles available through our two websites, nationalvanguard.org and NATALL, NATALL.com. And we also have a 24/7 radio network that is constantly up. You can listen at any time. And I would say almost half of the broadcast time on that network is Dr. Pierce's speeches, so they're easy to hear.
Very good. Yeah, there's some extremely inspiring, speeches and talks and everything else there, thoughts and kind of just big picture to much on the as we've talked about here, some of the issues that we face. So definitely take some time and listen to some of them. As I did say, you have, of course, Norwegian descent. I wanted to just ask about your thoughts about Europe a little bit. Have you ever been back? Do you keep up with your Norwegian side a lot? What's your take on I don't know if you're following what's happening in Norway, but it's not, of course, as bad as Sweden, but it's not too far behind, unfortunately.
Well, Norway is a very vulnerable country, one of the most vulnerable countries in Europe to non-white immigration, because it's population is so low. It also has a low population density. If I recall correctly, the entire population of Norway is less than the population of New York City.
And yeah, it's about 4 million, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe more now. Yeah.
A country of that size simply cannot stand an influx of tens or hundreds of thousands of racial aliens coming in. It's basically replacement migration, and Norway is a very fragile nation, and I'm very concerned about it. I've never been to Norway. I would like to go someday, very much so. I have been to Europe, but the only countries I've been in are England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. So I haven't been to continental Europe yet.
Yeah, there's as of 2013, there's just shy of, or a little bit over, I mean, 5 million people in Norway. And just as in, of course, Sweden is the most populated Scandinavian country, around, we're getting closer to 10 million. Unfortunately, a lot of that is immigration. The rise of the population in recent years is due to you know, immigration. But what I find funny about this discussion, Alfred, is or Kevin, sorry, is basically this aspect that we are always constantly called, you know, a majority, right? That all of these people that are coming into our countries, they're minorities, right? And we have to bring in diversity. We have to make sure that there's not too many white people everywhere, right? Because that's in itself, is, it seems to be a crime in this day and age. But the very aspect is that we are tremendous. Some of our countries in Europe, but also, of course, especially Scandinavia, are very, very small. And this doesn't seem to deter them from still pushing so-called minorities on us. We can have, you know, countries where they have in the excess of 100 million people coming into Norway, coming into Sweden and Denmark, and they're still being called minorities. It's just such a, I see it as a psychological, you know, warfare to a certain extent, to get us to go along with this idea, to make sure that, you know, we are replaced without any kind of opposition to it, right?
Yes, the enemy is very, very clever with language, and words are used as weapons, and I'm sure you're right about calling these fragile societies, these with very low populations and very low population densities, calling the indigenous people there majorities, while they're being swamped by peoples who are far, far more numerous on planet Earth. The white race as a whole is probably around a billion people, maybe a little bit less. I'm not certain of the exact figure. It depends on how you define white, I guess. But compared to a world population of 7 grading on up to 8 billion, that is a small minority. We are far from the majority. And of course, any race of people deserves its own territory. Any race would be unable to survive without its own territory. That's just one of the basic needs of any group of people that wants to survive on planet Earth. It needs some piece of land to call its own, to be exclusively theirs. If they don't have that, if they're denied that, then in my view, that's genocide. And we're being effectively denied that on all fronts, on the legal front, on the purely practical front of biomass and immigration, and on the moral front. We're being morally disarmed by the Jewish power structure to accept this dispossession. And let me say a word about evolution, too, because I think evolution, understanding the evolutionary aspects of this, is absolutely vital to really understand what's going on. All creatures that exist on planet Earth are a result of evolutionary branching. Every species that exists is a result of evolutionary branching. Doesn't matter if you're talking about human beings, about buffalo, about dogs, cats, mice, blades of grass even. They're all a result of evolutionary branching. And how do new species come into being? How do they do that branching? Well, the first thing that happens before there's a new species, races develop, for either through isolation or through mutations and behavioral differences. It could be a number of different ways, but in the beginning, it's a very small difference. Eventually, it develops into a racial difference, and if the process goes on long enough, a new species is born, and every single form of life had to go through that process to exist. And the essential part I want you to understand is that racial separation, the separation of the species being born, the new species being born, is necessary. It's a necessary part of that process. Without racial separation, evolution could not take place. Another way of saying it is, without exclusive territory for each people or race, evolution could not take place, and we would not be here. Advanced life on planet Earth would not be here. So far from being evil, racial separation is sacred and holy. It's a necessary part of the life process. Life as we know it wouldn't even exist without racial separation.
Yeah, I mean, everything. I mean, it's just so obvious to us, right? I mean, but it you know, needs to be reiterated over and over again, that everything in nature has territory, and the very existence of diversity among species, internally within species, among races and all those things, is predicated on the idea of boundaries, right? If you would just smash everything together, you mm-hmm. eradicate that diversity, and that's bad for a number of reasons. We can even look at it from the perspective of, you know, what they're trying to do with some of the farm, with the new, you know, genetically modified, you know, seeds and these kinds of things, that they actually are making the seeds weaker by genetically modifying them, by basically turning them into very similar genetically, which is maybe great one year for growing under certain conditions, but if something changes in those parameters, if it gets cooler one year or more moist or more water or something, it could result in the whole species dying out, basically, because they can't, you know, maintain under those changes, under those circumstances. But the lie here then is that they're calling this diversity, right, of bringing in more people. But if their plan were to be followed through, which is to basically mix everyone out, to blend everyone together, to become, you know, one people or whatever, then this diversity would be eradicated. And this is the big, you know, double standard in this thing that they're pushing on us, that they're calling it diversity, but it would just basically create a mono culture, a mono race. It would be nothing left at all. And so this is all just a lie. It's just something that they say to make us, again, go along with it. So we won't put up any resistance. So we will think it's the best thing ever. This is done for moral purposes. And it's just the greatest thing. It's so aggravating to when you begin to see these double standards, Kevin.
Yes, Henrik, you said it very, very well. This movement to mix all races, nations, and cultures together, whatever you want to call it. I call it the white genocide program of the Jewish power structure, but you could call it other things too. It's profoundly anti-life. It goes against the whole evolutionary history of life on Earth. The very first thing that the very first life forms had to evolve in order not to be destroyed was a wall, a cell wall.
That's right.
To define the difference between self and the rest of the world. And societies must do the same thing. And this, you look at the tree of life, this evolutionary branching from the very first life forms into the different kingdoms and the families and ultimately species and subspecies, including man. You see this continual branching as the different forms of life perfect their adaptations to their environment in different ways. What you almost never see, and when you do see it, it's a fluke. You almost never see branches coming back together. Forcing the branches back together is anti-evolution. It actually is anti-evolution. It's reversing evolution. Those changes develop for a reason. And we may know some of the reasons, and I may even wax poetic as to why these things happen and what the ultimate destiny will be. But the truth is that even people who have studied this for their entire lives don't fully know why those changes happened. And those changes, as the environmentalists say, a unique species, a unique subspecies, is extraordinarily valuable. It's extraordinary. And we are extraordinary, too. We deserve to be preserved just as much as the snail darter or the other endangered species on this planet. There is something very, very different about us Europeans that deserves to live. And I guess we're going to find out, Henrik, if we deserve to live, because if we don't fight to live, then we don't deserve to live.
Well, this is the quirk, right, of what we're facing. And I mean, I toss around, if you will, these ideas all the time. It's like, if people don't object to this, if they're not smart enough to see through it, if they don't organize and put up opposition and turn this around, you know, then at times I think, well, where's that greatness then? Are we not great then, right? Can't we see through this and basically oppose this ongoing genocide? But I think it's gradual, right? There's many different reasons why we ended up where we are, you know, today. And of course, it's external pressure, and some of it is internal. Some of our strengths have been used against us and weakened us, as you said before. High trust, for example, a tendency not to kind of maybe understand why people would lie, for example. Well, what's the reason for that, right? Mm-hmm. We tend to believe everything. I can just think back to my own grandparents of when they were reading things in the paper, and there was, you know, I try to explain certain things if it was politically or whatever, that, well, no, that's a lie, or they've done this, there's a different geopolitical agenda behind why they're pushing this or that. And she just couldn't kind of wrap her head around why would someone who write this article lie to her, right? The very communication of the message of spreading the word of a news item, of something that's happened, why would anybody lie, right? So there's exactly. Something in the mentality, which is, of course, kind of, you know, to a certain extent, I guess naive. But that's changing too, though, Kevin. I mean, we are waking up to this now, and with access to more information than ever, with more, you know, connections between people than ever, finally, I think we're seeing a rise in the number of people that are beginning to become aware of what it is that really is happening.
I think you're very much right, and I have noticed in the last 5 to 10 years a tremendous rise in people, many of them of the younger generation, spontaneously coming to the National Alliance and telling us that we have awakened them, or circumstances have awakened them, and they came to us. And it's definitely happening. And also, we don't have to wake everybody up. The people who really think for themselves have always been, I think, less than 10% of the population, but they are the people who lead the other 90%. We only have to convince a plurality of that 10% that we're right. And I think we're on our way. We're moving in the right direction. And the followers will follow whoever has the power.
Yeah, and that's both good and bad. I mean, we've been led down a very destructive path because we've had people, you know, convincing others, of course. But one of the things I want to ask you a little bit more about is pertaining to evolution and to development of different, you know, subspecies or races. And this aspect, too, that I question what all that is for, right? If we take a general stance of the morality that we have today, of someone who's just, you know, viewing the world as it's been told to them by media and education and all of this, they don't see, first of all, they claim they don't see these, any of these differences, first of all, and they claim that everyone is the same, and by having more people from other parts of the world, we have diversity, and that's a good thing, right? But I wonder how long it took us for developing into what we are. Of course, there's many different branches now of the European family, but the fact is, we don't know what those processes were entirely that created these unique traits that we have, right? And we don't even know if those ever again would come back. Certainly not in the way that we have them today. As you said, a branch have taken off, if you will, on the evolutionary tree. And even if we had, let's say, people from the Middle Eastern region or parts of Africa or something, I'd say that they in 1,000 years moved up to the cold climates of Europe again and lived there for a few thousand generations. Sure, maybe they would develop into something which is more similar to a European today, but it would never be the same people again. It would never be the same species or race again, basically. And so think about that. I mean, we might have 40,000 years in the making. We might have 200,000 years in the making. Might be even more than that. And we're ready and willing, many people, to sell that down the river just for this aspect of a very fleeting sense of morality that we have today, that somehow this is the right thing to do because that's what they're telling us on television. It's amazing that people are willing to sacrifice, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of years of uniqueness for this very aspect of what they've been told on the television or yes. In the movies or something. Amazing, isn't it?
It's an incredibly stupid thing to believe. I don't know. I suppose the religious among them think that Yahweh is going to give them an extra lollipop when they go to heaven, or maybe the more scientifically minded ones are just such lemmings that they just want to get along with the powers that be. I'm not really sure, but it is incredibly stupid. But I'm somewhat consoled by the fact that I think the majority of things that people have believed throughout history have been wrong. And most theories that have been entertained throughout most civilizations have been flawed, wildly flawed in one way or another. And we're just sort of chaotically, slowly, and painfully dragging ourselves toward an understanding of nature and the universe. And that's always been the job and the passion of a tiny minority. So it's our job as members of that tiny minority to take power and to lead the rest of us. And it's up to us to do that. If we don't do it, and I think the white race of the future is going to evolve. I don't know if it's going to be based on the old national groupings or even the subracial groupings of Nordic, Alpine, Mediterranean. I think it's going to be the people among our race who have what it takes, whatever part of Europe they come from. They're going to form the white race of the future, whatever that race may be, and if there is going to be one. I believe there is going to be one. I believe it's going to be very hard to kill us off, and the truth is an extremely powerful weapon, and we're also just as intelligent. Our best men are certainly just as intelligent as the best men of the other side. So I am not without hope.
Yeah, I mean, would you agree that many of the, you know, the establishment have also to a certain extent done this to themselves, right? That the creation of the alt-right, or the consequence, I should say, of what the alt-right has become and grown into, that's something that they have created themselves, right? They have continuously said that, you know, white people are racist, right? You have to be held responsible for everything your supposedly your forebears did. Your very existence, you know, is offensive to people. They have pushed people up against the wall in such a way that this is what's causing them to awaken. I can just speak for myself in this case, but, you know, I didn't set out on this path that I'm on now. I started the radio show on more of philosophical, esoteric grounds almost. Mm-hmm. I was into conspiracy and geopolitics and trying to understand the world. But it was just that the longer I was continuing to do that, I realized that, you know, there's people out there that hate me just because of the fact that I'm Swedish, right? They yes. They resent me. They see me as a threat. They were saying I need to be replaced by other people. You know, just me being Swedish, having our Swedish people in our country of Sweden, that in itself somehow is a crime now. And eventually, through being accosted in a sense, I started to wake up on the issue. But wait a minute, what is this? Why are they hating me so much? Why are they talking down to Swedish people and things like this? And so that's my point. I think that we've been pushed up against the wall, and to a certain extent, by giving everyone else identity politics and having them identify with whatever they are, but denying it to white people, has created this wave of resentment against the establishment that is refusing things to us as Europeans that they're allowing to everyone else, right?
Yes, that's very true. And our enemies have a tendency to be over the top to an almost crazy extent in everything they do. And so in this, they've also gone over the top, and they've created a tremendous reaction. Despite their wealth and despite their power, I am now convinced that millions of Americans basically agree with me on the race issue, and a large fraction of those people agree with me that Jewish power is the primary enabler of white genocide. So I think there's a lot of truth in what you said, and I also think that among the establishment, you know, the managers, the academics, the congressmen, the senators, the heads and subheads of government departments, the heads of corporations, they all are forced to ape this politically correct anti-white nonsense. But those people are above average in intelligence, and a very large percentage of them, especially with their daily experience of who they have to bow down to and kowtow to, they know we're right. And they know who it is that has the power and money that's forcing them to go around on their knees. And I guarantee you that plenty of them, maybe Donald Trump is one of them, don't like it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We can hope that he's maybe aware enough of it, but he just knows that he needs to kind of play along. And certainly, right, I mean, if he wasn't aware of it before, he certainly must be now, right? When he said, I mean, you've seen probably the stories that have been coming out of the media lately, when he's talking about bankers or the fact that he hates, you know, globalists and what the media has done. There's tons of publications with many Jewish authors that say, oh my God, he's an anti-Semite, right? He's pointing us out, which is like an admission of the fact that, oh, okay, so you're saying that you do own the banking system and you do own the media, right? I mean, it's hilarious.
Well, it would be impossible, I think, to rise to the top in the dog-eat-dog world of New York City real estate without realizing the extent of Jewish power. However, he says he loves them. I also find it impossible to believe that any United States senator of any long standing could possibly be unaware of who controls this country financially behind the scenes. They are all aware of it. They all know that we're right when we criticize the Jewish power structure and the Israel lobby. They know it. Above anybody else in this world, they know it.
What would it take, do you think, for that environment to change? I mean, they have to a certain extent managed to get us into a position where basically just even recognize or criticizing a group, which frankly, I mean, let's face it, there's many other groups in America and in Europe that have political interests. They drive certain things. It's become maybe more and more acceptable, you know, to a certain extent anyway, to criticize, for example, Muslims or you know, organized Islamic organizations within our countries, things like this, right? But the very aspect that they for a long time managed to make it absolutely unacceptable to criticize, you know, Jewish power or Jewish interest groups or you know, point out the fact that they have privilege, you know, they point on white people and say that we have privilege when in fact, you know, they as a very wealthy group you know, has that privilege. But what do you think would have to happen for that to change, to become? I'm not saying that, oh, we have to sit around and wait for that to become acceptable. But if you follow my train of thought, that, you know, get to a point where we basically openly just can talk about this, like as normal people that are recognizing reality, that's just saying, hey, look, it's like you can think of it what you want, but the fact is, here we have a very powerful group, and they're lobbying and organizing for their self-interest, right?
Yes. Well, I think we're getting there, Henrik. I think it's getting better. More and more people are speaking out. And if you just read the controlled media, their little playpen where they control everything, it looks worse than ever. But if you talk to people in the restaurants or in the workplace around this town, if you go to Trump rallies, which I went to my first Trump rally here in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, just the other day, if you talk to people in uncensored forums on the internet, like Twitter or Facebook, where people, some people at least, are willing to speak their minds, I think you discover there's a lot more free speech on these issues than there used to be 5 years ago. It's the trend. We're still small, sure, and we don't have anywhere near the money. We need more support. Groups like the National Alliance and I'm sure Red Ice Radio need 10,000 times the support we're getting to do what we really want to do. But I think that people are waking up, and history is unpredictable. It's hard for me to say what it would take to turn all of these people who know what's going on into partisans for our side. I don't know the answer to that question, but I will say that I believe that the third worldization of European civilization in the United States and Europe and elsewhere is definitely going to bring consequences. Things are going to stop working efficiently. The money is going to run out. The wealth transfer is going to bleed us dry. We're already seeing a huge wave of suicides in the parts of the United States where business almost doesn't exist anymore. Industry has fled. The rust belt is really not just rusting, but corroding into nothingness, and those people have just been abandoned. I think that as things stop working, people will start looking for answers. And I don't believe that that this unnatural, crazy, dysfunctional, unworkable system is going to last too much longer.
No, and then you have terrorism on the rise on top of it, right, with the migration crisis, so-called migration crisis, with an invasion, a full-on invasion of Europe. You've had you know, ISIS and other groups taking advantage of that. You literally have images of people, you know, beheading someone in Syria, and then, you know, a month later or two, they are seen photographed in Germany or Austria or something like that. I mean, it's insane. It's absolutely crazy. But I think if that is what it takes for people to wake up, well, so be it then. Unfortunately, I don't like it. I wish it, you know, we didn't have to go that route. But the fact is, you know, if we don't wake up and realize that, you know, we are being targeted for who we are, and the very fact that we have, you know, very powerful enemies that are finding these different ways at you know, pushing up against the wall in this way, then this is what has to happen. We have to go the hard way on this one, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's like terrorism that I would assume would be the reason why people said, okay, well, that's enough. We have to close the border now. We have to take control of the situation beforehand. But it's actually gone on remarkably long. But I think after two summers of the so-called migration crisis in Europe, we're finally beginning to see a more hard-lined rhetoric and parties, you know, in the various European countries more openly beginning to address this issue. And that's a positive trend, despite the fact that the conditions now that we have is sadly much, much worse than they were only two, three years ago.
Yes, I think the Jewish power structure has really overplayed its hand in encouraging this mass migration, because it's making people angry. And thank God they're getting angry. It's about time.
Yeah, it is about time. I want to hear your thoughts on the future for America a little bit. How you see things demographically. I mean, I think we have certain papers that are announcing and rejoicing over the fact that finally, you know, the people born in America are going to be non-whites, right? They're going to be, you know, America is going to be a diverse country, and that's a wonderful thing. You know, you see headlines like that all the time. How do you think this is going to turn out demographically, Kevin? And do you see, I don't know, America as a country of breaking up in factions eventually because of the fact of what you raised before with functionality and maybe even infrastructure kind of breaking down along the way? Or is Trump going to sweep in as a kind of a last-minute savior and manage to turn things around? Maybe not, of course, fully demographically, but at least America as a kind of a wealthier nation being able to turn things around again. What's your projection?
I think the more America falls as a wealthy nation, the better it is for the white people in America, because it will increase the likelihood they will organize and they will begin to accept the necessity of identity politics. Really, identity politics are the only politics. And the richer, the more they can keep the Ponzi game going, and the more wealthy people are, the more they're going to not be interested in change, because people like comfort. As for predicting the future, I'll say I don't like to predict the future politically, because it's so chaotic. I mean, right now it looks like we're heading for a Brazil-like America, a Brazil with
right.
nukes, a racially mixed America, although I don't think it's ever going... I mean, even Brazil is not fully racially mixed, and it's never going to be. There's a certain percentage of the white population in Brazil and in the United States that refuses to mix. And right now it's around 90% of white people are marrying other white people, despite 30 years of propaganda to the contrary. And
right.
I think that's going to continue. I think the white people have to start thinking in terms of either revolution or secession, and stop thinking in terms of the ballot box. Because the ballot box, even if Trump gets in, the ballot box is stacked against us. The number of births in this country to white people is now a minority of births. And those people are going to vote. And if the corrupt establishment manages to hold on to power much longer, they're going to change the laws so the tens of millions of illegals will also be able to vote. There's no hope in voting. You might as well just forget about voting. But things are so unpredictable. Look at what happened in Ceausescu's Romania. I mean, one day Ceausescu controlled the secret police, he controlled all the radio stations, he controlled all the newspapers, he controlled all the television stations, and he controlled the police, who could knock on your door at midnight and carry you off to a prison if you said the wrong word. He had absolute and total power, and in a few weeks it all unraveled. It all unraveled because people saw that it could unravel, and they changed their behavior very quickly. And the same thing could happen in the United States. I hope it does.
Yeah, that's true. There's an interesting perspective on it, that it's almost like when a consensus is reached, the tipping point, or that moment when, you know, you pour sugar in a glass of water or something, and at a certain point, it crystallizes, right? It just boom, and then the change happens, and it kicks in very quickly like that, and that is true. I mean, it's such a repressive environment, and yes, certainly we're seeing a gradual change, but I also think, the more the system is trying to push back that reaction, the worse they're going to make it for themselves, right? So that they try to silence us, they try to put the lid on, they try to lie in the media, they try to talk, mention lies and things like that. But as we continue to point out those things, the whole system in itself, despite the fact that it's very powerful, is something that we can use against it to prove constantly. See, yes. they hate us. See, they're trying to lie to us. Or the movies is a psychological operation. They're doing this to manipulate us, etc. So I see it as a kind of a jiu-jitsu to a certain extent. You take the power of the system and turn that back against itself to help to, at the very least, point out to people what it is that they're trying to do. And they're trying to do those things for a very specific reason. And as long as we can, you know, reach that point that the people have a level of understanding of those basic facts, it can go very quickly.
I think we're headed in that direction, because more and more I see people laughing at them. And once they've started to become objects of fun, then I think their time, or I should say their days, are numbered.
Yeah. Now, even if there wasn't, let's say, at least initially, a territory, I guess we can just talk about America for a moment here, that isn't exclusively white, or predominantly white, we should say, where it's an idea that, okay, here's where, you know, white people live, and they have a right, just as all these other people do around the world, to have their own country, to have their own, you know, their self-determination in their own hands, basically. Even if we don't have that immediately, if you will, or initially, then part of the issue and part of the problem is maybe to just make people develop a mind where they are, to a certain extent, separated, if you will, from the rest of the world, right? That if they, even if the conditions were bad, they could still live in a Brazil, as you made the comparison before, as long as they made the conscious choice of saying, well, you know, conditions aren't ideal, but I'm going to make a conscious effort to find someone who is like me, right? And make sure that the traits that I have, the uniqueness, those are things that I want to continue to pass down to my children, basically, right? And I know, just preface this again, I mention it all the time, but yes, I know that there are people that, you know, fall in love across, you know, racial boundaries. There are people travel. I mean, you're never going to be able to stop that. I think any law to stop that would be also actually self-defeating to a certain extent. Obviously, you don't have to create the condition that makes this super easy for people either. But what I'm saying is that as long as people have a mind where they have their own identity and their own racial group very prominent, that will go a long way, even if we live in a territory which is very mixed racially, if you know what I'm saying, Kevin.
Yes, I think that if we look at certain other groups that live in an outer world, which may not be racially different from them, but may be religiously or culturally different from them, they have a whole infrastructure of a belief system, a social support network, an economic network that holds them together. Look at the Amish in the United States. Look at the Jews. They have the similar network, and they are specialists. They are the prime example of a group that has evolved to live among hostile natives. Well, we have to develop a system like that too. I think we need a belief system. We need an economic support system. We need a way of choosing our own leaders. And we need a set of rules for our own society, because we in the United States, I believe, unless something radical happens very fast, we are going to have to be a nation within a nation. And we're going to have to learn to live that way. Those that don't learn to do that will just melt into the ghetto.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad, as we've pointed out here during this show, folks. It's like we're losing this precious diversity, unique traits, and all this with this pipe dream that I think, you know, that there's many ulterior motives here. But if we just take it at face value of what we're being told, it's just a pipe dream where I don't know, I guess officially they think that this somehow is going to solve, you know, racism or something, or it's going to bring us world peace if we all look the same and think the same, behave the same, talk the same language. I guess then they think, well, it's not going to be any divisions or any war or fighting, so that will be peaceful and that's good, right? I don't know how ridiculous and how kind of kindergarten level they you know, think that this is going to be resolved on, but sometimes it feels like it's just that silly that most people perceive it to be. What do you think, Kevin?
I think that inspiring people to do something, whether that something is useful and positive or negative and destructive, requires a goal which is over the horizon. And they have given these people a false goal, a goal which can never be achieved, but which, in a way, that's an advantage, because that goal of harmony and peace in a non-racial society with no racism or hate, it's never going to happen. It can't happen. But they hold this like, a golden carrot just beyond the horizon. And the people need something to believe in. Religion has fallen apart. The old values of the American Republic have fallen apart. And so this gives meaning to stupid people's lives. And it's very sad when if they had their own people leading them, particularly the best among their own people leading them, I think we could hold out a much greater, achievable, and truly sacred goal to them, the goal of not only surviving, but becoming better and better with each generation, both not just culturally better and not just scientifically better, not just educationally better, but biologically better, which is the root of all those other things, with each succeeding generation. And eventually to make sure that our continually evolving, upwardly evolving race can leave this planet and a certain death which waits for us on this planet. I think those goals are what true leaders would be holding up before the people and inspiring those who simply don't have what it takes to think for themselves. Every group of people, every people needs leaders, and we have very, very bad, very corrupt, very bought off leaders.
Absolutely true. That is so true, and I'm so glad that Trump is talking in those terms and planting those seeds in millions of people's heads and making that acceptable. Whether we agree with, you know, him at the end of the day, so what? You know, it's like if people can start thinking in those terms, people will be ready for change, or for making sure that, you know, true heroic, virtuous, good leader comes along that actually is thinking about the people first. It's so foreign to us, that idea today. We're so almost afraid of it. I think that's one of the reasons why so many white people go to like libertarianism and things like this as well. They think it's just simply the solution to run in the opposite direction of what government means or what leadership means. But yes. I still think it's still an expression of them wanting to improve things, but they can't really put their finger on what that is.
Exactly right. I think when you have an enemy government, a government which hates you and wants you dead and does everything to achieve that goal, you're likely to distrust government and be against government. And a lot of people just think, well, if we just cut the government down to size, our problems are solved. But the truth is that every people needs a government. We're not going to survive in this world of hostile peoples and nations without a government, without a powerful military, without a council of men to guide the destiny of our people. Would just be chaos, and we'd be tromped over and ruled by the Chinese or somebody else in short order. The thing that is alien to Americans is Americans have not, for many, many decades, maybe 100 years, or more, have not had a government that is their own. They have had an enemy government, so it's no wonder they hate the government. I often try to put it this way, and that's to think about what is the meaning of life. You get right down to basics. Why are we here? What is the meaning of life? And the truth is, although I have my own ideas about the direction in which that question has to be answered, I don't really know. I don't think the best men on planet Earth in all of the ages had a final answer to that question. So therefore, because that's true, because even our best men don't have all the final answers to why we're here and what is the meaning of life and what should we do, that the answer is we need better men. And so therefore, at this stage of our understanding, at this stage of our evolution, the purpose of life is making better men, making a better race. And that's what the National Alliance is in the final analysis all about.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very important point that you bring up. You mentioned it earlier in terms of religious need for a religion. Religious need has been replaced with I don't know, liberal social justice warriors, you know, kind of traits and things like this. It's such another part of the problem that we have a belief in equality. It's a fallacy, of course, of equality, but you know, we're so far from it that, you know, as you say, that we're in a place now where most people don't even want to improve or become better, right? They in fact, they want to tear down people that are better achievers or those who have a tendency to excel above the rest or something like that. This very wicked need to make sure that everyone is on the same level is not only destroying us, you know, now and here, but it's actually also impairing us in the future, right? That these bright individuals, these people who can excel above the rest, even the fruits of their achievements is something that would actually benefit other people. But most people are so blind to this because they just have a blind faith in equality that they're willing to sacrifice all of that. I think we're in for, you know, if we don't begin to observe these issues and take them seriously, just this aspect of low IQ people, for example, multiplying tremendously is a huge problem. It's one that, of course, people refuse to address and even think about because that's what the Nazis did, right? So we must go in the opposite direction. That's just the right thing to do. But the fact is, it's going to have such tremendous consequences that it's going to be difficult to, yes, to run a functioning society eventually down the road. And people just have to realize that they have to face this at some point, or it's going to face you, right?
Well, the Chinese are openly researching genetics, and one writer believes, Jeffrey Miller believes, they're implementing eugenics. And I think the society that successfully implements eugenics, in other words, it's not any kind of Dr. Frankenstein kind of thing. It's just the country that successfully ensures that a large percentage of the best people in their society pass on their excellent genes to the next generation and discourage the worst people from passing on their genes to the next generation. That society is going to advance like lightning. And the society that does the opposite, and we're doing the opposite, encouraging wealth transfers and encouraging in every way the birth of the least intelligent and those of the worst character and the least creativity, is, to use the vernacular, going down the toilet.
That's correct. Yep, absolutely. So kind of leading on from this a little bit, a couple of more points here that we can discuss that I find interesting in the conversation here. It has to do with culture of our, you know, kind of continuing our own, what do I call it? Yes, cultural values maybe, but there's more attached to that, such as us telling our own stories, us having our own heroes, our own role models. We've allowed this to be maybe not hijacked but taken over, as we mentioned before, by Hollywood, for example, that we've lost this connection to our own people and to our own stories. They've taken over this, and now people sit and watch, you know, superhero movies instead of telling the tales as we used to do. Mm-hmm. So I have always seen a very important aspect to this is to reclaim the culture and reclaim the culture that is ours and continuing to spread that on our own terms instead of being allowing someone else to do it or offering us, maybe as we're seeing today, kind of a facsimile where people maybe temporarily have this need for mythology and association temporarily kind of satisfied because they can go to a movie theater and see it, but in the long run it has very detrimental effects. But what do you think about what should be done in terms of continuation and maybe even advancement of our own culture, of our own, you know, value system? How do we promote that best, for the lack of a better term? How do we make people choose ours, if you will, instead of the facsimile that we're being offered on mainstream media and in the movie theaters?
Until our people take control of their own destiny and their own territory somewhere, and when we do that, of course, we can dispossess the enemies who control the media that our people are watching now or reading now. Until we can do that, the most important thing we can do is do what you're doing. We need to make our own media. We need our own television shows. We need our own feature films. We need our own book publishing companies, encyclopedia publishing companies. We need our own media ramified completely in every aspect that you could possibly imagine. And it needs to be under the control of wise men of our people who have the best interests of our people at heart. That's what we need to do, and that's what the National Alliance is beginning to do. And I can see over in Sweden that's what you're doing, and I'm very, very happy that you're doing it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing that expression now, Kevin. You know, we have mergers of, you know, Time Warner and AT&T, and you have, I mean, at the end of the day, I think you have about six major companies that control the whole media. And as these giants, as these dinosaurs are beginning to merge together and get even larger to try to survive, we're seeing the emergence of small cells, if you will, that is creating, well, I guess to make the analogy then, of a kind of a new life arising, and the time of the dinosaurs is coming to an end, more or less.
Well, people need to support these new media. People need to buy the books.
Yeah.
They need to support the people who are speaking out for them, and they need to withdraw to the extent that they can from the system. They need to homeschool their kids, if at all possible. That is very important. Homeschool your kids. Don't send them to the state schools. If you do have to send them to the state schools for some reason, teach them at home also, and evaluate every day what lessons they have learned, and give them the truth. Give them old books that were written before political correctness set in. I'm not saying you can't watch movies. You can buy DVDs of older films before the rot had really set in, and you can provide context for the more modern films, but basically unplug that damned cable. Don't let the networks into your life. Don't let the networks especially into your children's lives. Take control of your family's own destiny, and that will help the new media grow.
That's right. Cancel your cable subscription and give it to people that matter. You know, absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, Kevin, very interesting having you here. Thank you so much for your time today. You have a personal website as well, of course, kevinalfredstrom.com. People can find more there. But give us the two other websites again for National Alliance and National Vanguard.
Yes, the main organizational website for the National Alliance, where you can find our foundational documents and our beliefs, is natall.com, natall.com. If you somehow happen to hear this broadcast and you don't have the internet, you can write to us even at Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee 37680, USA. And if you want to read a daily updated news magazine written from our point of view, we're at nationalvanguard.org. That's all one word, nationalvanguard.org. And almost all of my work, even more than I put on my own personal website, is on nationalvanguard.org.
Very good. We'll have links up on our site, folks, to Kevin's sites and the sites mentioned here. All right. Well, thank you again. Good to have you here. We really appreciate your time. Keep it up, and maybe we can do it again in the future.
Thank you, Henrik. It was delightful to talk to you and to meet you.
All righty. There we go. We're off the record then, Kevin. Thank you so much. Awesome. It was great.
Okay. Awesome. I hope I did well. I'm not the best extemporaneous speaker in the world, but
it was great.
Put my heart into it.
It was great. Of course. No, it was great. So we'll send out, links and everything else when the show goes up. I think we're going to get to work on it later this evening and have it up by tomorrow. Do you have, by the way, a photo that you want us to use to go along with the show? We usually make an image kind of for the show as well. So if you have a high-res image or photo that you can send to us, that would be great.
Sure. Where do I send it?
You can send it to, I guess, right over Skype. Just drag and drop it into my chat box, or I'll give you the email right there, so in the chat, and that way you can send it there.
Okay, I'll do that later today then.
Very good, thank you. And as I said, we'll send you the links when the show is up on the websites. We'll send you a members pass and everything else that comes along with that. And
thank you.
Thanks again. Really appreciate it, Kevin.
I enjoyed it. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Let's do that. Have a good evening.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.